Welcome to Sake Deep Dive, the sake podcast for the beyond beginner. Thank you for joining us once again on our fantastic voyage into the deep, deep lore of sake brewing. I am your host, Jim Ryan, sake author, general all-around kind of sake dude. Joined, as always, by my friend and co-host, Andrew Russell.
How are you, Jim?
Doing all right, Andrew. What's going on in Andrew land?
Just trying to survive this horrible Japanese weather that's now upon us. It is now officially tsuyu, or rainy season. So this is quite possibly the worst time to visit Japan, or be in Japan, I guess.
Yeah. It's rainy, it's sweaty, it's humid, and there's mold everywhere. The bugs get huge.
Yeah, they are humongous this year.
Have you had some traumatic experiences already?
Working in a sake brewery, you're likely to encounter these kind of things. It's very possible, you know, old Edo period or maybe even earlier buildings tend to attract, you know, usually the outhouses, not the kura themselves. The fermentation rooms are very clean, as are the motoba, but it's the outhouses that, you know, the back buildings you have to go and fetch something from. There's been more than one occasion where I've encountered some oversized insects, shall we say.
Oh, it's all part of that closeness to nature that everybody loves about sake.
Absolutely.
All right. So we're going to get a little bit more modern today. We're diving back into the old starter methods. And our topic today is kind of update a little bit. What are we talking about today, Andy?
We are talking about sokujo.
Sokujo.
The quick fermentation or quick fermenting yeast starter is often the translation that you hear. But it's worth pointing out that a lot of people in the industry very simply divide all moto into two categories. Those are sokujo and kimoto.
Right.
I personally don't, and I think you're probably the same. I wouldn't put bodai moto in the kimoto category. I think they're fundamentally different, but they do get lumped together quite often. And then everything else is sokujo. However, as we're going to find out, there is much more to sokujo than just fast brewing. Like any of these topics, there are numerous different facets to this. So yeah, this is going to be an interesting one.
So just to sort of start things out, there are two core things that I want to look at or talk about today. The first is sort of the history. And in particular, the history of sokujo is tied very, very closely to the history of Yamahai and basically the modernization of sake brewing. And I think that that's just a fascinating topic. And the other thing is that sokujo is much more complex. Like you said, Andy, there's much more to it than just, oh, it's all sokujo. So I think it's going to be fun to get into the details and get into the weeds and stir up a lot of facts. So, just let's get started with the history. Let's start at the beginning. This was my homework, and it was fascinating because I have to admit that the one of the reasons that I wanted to look into the history so much this time was this kind of timely misunderstanding. Like there's just been a lot of conversation recently about when sokujo hit the sort of market, or when it became a thing. And so some people seem to be under the impression that it predates Yamahai.
Right.
And that's kind of an odd thing to believe, just in general.
Yeah, it wouldn't follow the progression timeline.
It wouldn't follow the progression. It wouldn't make sort of rational sense. So let's get it sort of why that might be. Japan was in this long feudal period that we call the Edo period. And a lot of people say that was kind of sake brewing's golden age when it really came into its own. And that lasted until 1867. From 1868, Japan slipped into the Meiji period, which is the modern period. It's when Japan started to become a technological nation. It started, you know, laying railroad tracks, and it built steel foundries, and it became an extremely technologically centered nation. And it also adopted a lot of what we would call, I guess, the scientific method And the sake brewing industry was no exception. They started to really, really focus on research and studying and understanding sake brewing at a deeper level, particularly in terms of chemistry and microbiology, right? This is what we're talking about. This is where we get into the real issues. So let's talk about a timeline. In 1904, the Ministry of Finance, which is, you know, the government arm that is in control of money, they had basically realized that there was a lot of money. There was a lot of tax income coming in through sake, and it was in the government's best interest to improve it, to help support it, to help drive that industry. And so in 1904, they founded the National Research Institute of Brewing. Now, it had a different name back at the very beginning, but it very quickly just became the NRIB. And the main goals of the NRIB were to improve and develop brewing technology and improve and develop brewing skills, with a goal of sort of stable production and improved labor conditions. And from the very beginning, they started looking at Motul.
Seems and logical.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's what you were looking at, right? So 1904, the great thing about this, the thing that I absolutely love about this is they started publishing a journal almost from the very beginning. And some blessed person, I don't know who it was, but I will always be grateful, has digitally preserved those journals. They are online for free, in searchable, downloadable PDFs. It's a thing of beauty.
Like, as long as you speak Japanese.
As long as you read
Japanese.
Or... Yeah, exactly. As long as you read Japanese. And let me just sort of be perfectly honest here. These really old ones, you have to be able to read weird Japanese, because they use kanji that are no longer used. They use, for some of the articles, they use katakana for all of the grammar instead of hiragana, which is just a real pain to read. So yeah, but very, very quickly, you start to see articles from two guys in particular. These are important names. They're Kamajiro Eda and Kinichiro Kagi. And Kinichiro Kagi was researching the development of lactic acid through lactic bacterial fermentation in motos. Can anyone guess what he is credited with inventing?
Yamaha.
And then of course comes Kamajiro Eda, who researched the role of lactic acid in moto, which of course leads us to Sokujo.
It does indeed. This is a key point for Sokujo.
Absolutely. Right. And these guys, they knew each other. They were working on roughly sort of very, very similar topics at the same time. Right. Their research was going on essentially simultaneously. Now, in 1909, Kagi Kinichiro published experimental notes on Yama Oroshi in Moto, outlining the Yama Oroshi Haishi method. Yamahai, 1909. In 1910, Kamajiro Eda, he publishes a detailed description of Sokujo, April 26, 1910, uses the term Sokujo Moto, right? Now, to me, we've got 1909 Yamahai experimental notes, 1910, a detailed description of Sokujo Moto from the National Research Institute of Brewing. That's essentially the simultaneous, right? It's the same time. Because, you know, they've been researching this. For example, there's an article in 1909 about Futsu Moto versus a Sokujo Moto, which is a theoretical use of lactic acid in Moto. Same time as Kagi's notes.
And I would be right in saying that at the time, if someone said Futsu Moto, what they're talking about is Kimoto.
Absolutely. Like it is literally called Futsu Moto in the journal articles. But what they're talking about is Kimoto, because of course, it's the only thing that people are doing. There's nothing else yet.
Hence the futsu.
Right. So 1909, Yamahai outlined in a journal article. 1910, Sokujo outlined in a journal article. These are when the processes that we call Yamahai and Sokujomoto were sort of publicly announced. But publicly announced in a journal is one thing. Like actually on the ground being used in breweries is something else entirely, right? Now, Andy, when people talk about the move from Kimoto to Yamahai and then to Sokujo, like how does that story usually go?
Well, this is just personally, but within the circles, the people that I've spoken to and consulted with, the elephant in the room here about which would come first is that you still have one vital component that's missing that would allow people to do Sokujomoto, and that is, of course, cultured yeasts. So if you talk about the transition from Futsumoto, Kimoto to Yamahai and then to Sokujo, the final piece of the jigsaw, I guess, would be cultured yeasts, because you can make Yamahai with or without cultured yeasts, as you can with Kimoto, obviously. In fact, they're synonymous for not using cultured yeasts, but you can't do that with Sokujo. So that transition, that final piece, does come in a bit later. You're saying these journals were published in 1909 and 1910 respectively. It wasn't until a bit later that Kyokai number one makes the scene. So that would be the point where it would transition. But I guess from what I'd read somewhere before, brewers were actually quite slow to take up on Sokujo. So perhaps you can sort of elaborate that on a bit. But from what I understood, it wasn't something that brewers just suddenly jumped up and went, "Eureka, we've got this new method." It would have taken a long, probably quite drawn out process to convince them to, ditch these old methods like Kimoto, and I guess Yamahai wouldn't be in that, and then adopt these new methods.
You're absolutely exactly 100% right. Just sort of as an aside, when I was researching this stuff, I discovered a book that was just published in April of this year, all about Kinichiro Kagi, the founder of Yamahai Brewing Method, and it has some absolute gems in here. So after this sort of revelation, right, when they discovered all of these, microbiological secrets, and they had found that lactic acid was vital to the production of a stable yeast starter, the NRIB, the government, was like, "Yeah, this is great. Let's teach people how to do this." And they actually wrote a pamphlet on new brewing methods, introducing both Yamahai and Sokujo as ways of quickly creating stable yeast starters. And like they sent these guys out. They said, go forth and teach. And they went out and they started teaching people, and they were evangelizing these new methods together, both of them, Yamahai and Sokujo, at the same time. And there's actually a chart in this book outlining sort of how that progressed. So starting in 1917, this chart says 75% of all starters were what they call Futsumoto, or the current methods, which are basically Kimoto with some Bodaimoto as well. Mizumoto is what they call it in the book. 1917, 18%, 18.7% was Yamahai, and 5% was Sokujo. All right, we're going to skip ahead a few years to 1925. Yamahai is sort of growing quite a bit. It's up to 24%. Sokujo has also jumped a bit. It's up to 13%. Kimoto and Bodaimoto are down to 61%. Now, as of 1933, Yamahai is a big chunk at 30%. Sokujo has jumped up to 24%, while Kimoto has fallen to 44%. So that's 1917 to 1933. That's a long time, right? It's 16 years. So it's not this instantaneous thing. And like you mentioned, one of the big factors for Sokujo was cultured yeast. Another big factor was lactic acid. You know, the book notes that in particularly in Western Japan, which is far from Tokyo, which is far from, you know, the research centers of the universities and things, people were particularly slow to take up Sokujo because they couldn't get acid.
Yeah.
So once the Kyokai started supplying acid and yeast, basically post-World War II, Sokujo, boom, it exploded and took over. All right, and so that's your timeline. 1904, NRIB was founded. 1909, Yamaha was described in a journal article. 1910, Sokujo was described in a journal article. As of 1917, almost no one was using either one of those styles. 1933, basically half of all sake brewed was either Yamaha or Sokujo. The other half was Kimoto. And then after World War II, say roughly 1946, Sokujo just took off.
Yeah, that's almost quite sad in a way, because 1946 is when Kyokai number 6, or better known as Aramasa Kobo, Aramasa yeast, that was the year that was isolated from Aramasa and released to the general brewers. So that whole 1 to 5 existed in a time where not that many people were using them.
Yeah, well, it's interesting because they just weren't ready, right? The technology was really focused in, I guess you'd say, urban areas, Tokyo. The NRIB eventually moved to Hiroshima, but Western Japan, it didn't get a lot of that sort of new modern technological innovation, even though, of course, Western Japan was where most of the old innovations were all focused.
I guess that leads us nicely then on to, I guess, actually talking a little bit more about what defines Sokujo then.
Right.
So we've talked about Kimoto in the past. So this is a very diverse method of making moto that relies on a natural lactic acid fermentation to occur. So that's Kimoto in a nutshell. The principles, or the core principles to Sokujo, are very different. They do not rely on a naturally occurring lactic acid fermentation. Lactic acid is added at the start, and that is one of the key principles to Sokujo. You shut out unwanted microorganisms by adding commercially made lactic acid very early on in the process. So that is one of the main reasons why stylistically Sokujo is quite significantly different from Kimoto. The other, you know, main characteristic, I suppose, is that there's a high concentration of purity in the yeast. And that comes from adding cultured yeasts again very early in the process. So you shut out unwanted yeasts, wild yeasts, through having a high concentration of pure cultured yeasts. And that's why Sokujo really expresses the characteristics of yeast very well, because it has this environment very early on where that particular yeast that you've put in will thrive and block out everything else. So that's really what Sokujo is in a nutshell. But obviously, you know, what we'll talk about later is going a layer below that and talking about the different kinds of Sokujo, of which there are many.
It also probably would help people to grasp a couple of things to point out why that's such a big deal in terms of production. Because, you know, like I mentioned, the NRIB was all about promoting and developing a stable and faster production. And so when we have the traditional methods of Bodaimoto and Kimoto, they take a long time to set up that yeast starter, right? We're looking at, like, how long are we looking at there, Andy, for a traditional Kimoto?
I mean, a traditional Kimoto could take 4 to 5 weeks.
Right.
That's Moto Tsuri. That's using pole mashing, which we've talked about before. I still haven't changed my opinion on that. I don't consider that the defining feature of Kimoto as one category. Before they were using Moto Tsuri, it would have taken a lot longer to actually make Kimoto. So maybe, you know, 5 to 6 weeks. This is what we talked about in the Kimoto episode. That pole ramming is actually a very fast way of doing Kimoto. So if you then compare that to Sokujo, Sokujo takes about 2 weeks. If you're doing one of the slowest methods, it takes 2 weeks. But there's much quicker versions of Sokujo within that, some of which only take 5 to 6 days.
Right.
So yeah, that is really significant. But what you were mentioning before as well, though, about why the NRIB were so keen to do this, really comes down to stability. Sokujo, I've heard people say, oh, it's so easy to make, and these are always non-brewers, and you can't go wrong and what have you. It isn't to that extent. There are still a lot you can do wrong with Sokujo, but the chances of spoilage compared to Kimoto, it's night and day. Lactic acid is added to the moto almost immediately at the earliest stage, what they call mizukoji, which is just water in koji. At that point, in fact, before you've even put the koji in, a lot of people will put the lactic acid in. So if you think about the process of Kimoto, it can take about 2 weeks plus to get that lactic-rich environment, you know, and that's when the moto is at its most vulnerable because there's nothing defending it. There's nothing defending the mash through that entire, let's say, 2 week period. With Sokujo, right from the beginning, the yeast is coming into that environment where it has that clean environment that the unwanted microorganisms have all been blocked out through the lactic acid. So it is much more stable than, you know, Kimoto or Yamahai.
And of course, you know, keeping in mind that Yamahai is a development of Kimoto, it's still within that same process of sort of fomenting a natural bacterial fermentation. It's just faster a bit than the traditional Kimoto. All right. All right. So Sokujo is this method where they're building a fast, stable fermentation starter using a kind of lab-produced lactic acid and cultured yeast. Is that it? Are we done, Andy?
Not by a long shot.
So, yeah, what are we missing?
Well, I mean, it's like anything. That early method that would have been that Edda would have come up with back at the, I guess, the end of the Meiji period, what, 1910. That is the prototype. Now, as we know, brewers very rarely get to the prototype stage and then go, that'll do. You know, they are inherently curious and adventurous and looking for better ways. And you know, there's no surprise within the Sokujo classification. There are, depending on who you speak to, between three and four main types, I guess you could call them. These are the ones we'll focus on tonight because it would be a very long episode if we tried to cover every single one of them. But the one that we mentioned before, which takes about 2 weeks, is known in the industry as Futsu Sokujo. That takes, as I said, about 2 weeks to make. The temperature that you usually hear, the fermentation temperature you usually hear, is between 18 and 20 degrees Celsius. That's your standard moto. Now, what I mentioned before about people saying Sokujo is so easy and you can't go wrong, and in actual fact, if you look at what's involved in Futsu Sokujo, it's actually quite complicated. You still have to do a lot of the elements that you would with Kimoto, but you've just kind of skipped forward to the lactic acid stage. But you still then have to do all the hard work in terms of keeping the temperature low, then raising it gradually, then through analysis, waiting until the optimum point to then drop the temperature back down. And obviously, what we're trying to do in all these stages is balance our desired sugar content, the vitality of the yeast, and acidity as well, obviously, and get it to a stage where when it's finished, you have a very sweet, sour, acidic yeast starter ready to go into the main fermentation. So, like I said, there is actually a lot of work with a standard Sokujo, which is why there has been attempts to improve it. And I guess one of the most famous attempts happened in the town next to where I am in Takehara, and it's a brewery I think we've mentioned before actually on this podcast called Nakao Shuzo. They're very famous. They're, I guess, a reasonably sized brewery as well, the biggest in Takehara by quite a long shot. They make Seikyo and Maboroshi, or
Maboroshi,
yeah, Maboroshi are the two famous brands. I think a lot of people overseas are definitely going to heard of Seikyo. It's a very well-known brand. But in 1940, Nakao Kiyomaru, who was the Kuramoto, I guess he would be Kuramoto Toji, I'm not sure, but he developed a system called Koon Sokujo. And Koon, it means high temperature. That's the Japanese kanjis for high and then temperature. That's just the simple translation for it. But it also gets given the name Amazake Sokujo. Now, Amazake is, I think, is actually a better way of describing what it is. The process of making Amazake, which as we know has got no alcohol in it, is you mix either rice koji in water or sometimes just koji, and you keep it at a very high temperature. And what that does is it gives a rapid conversion of starch to sugar. So the sugar content, really rapidly develops. You get this really rich sugar content, which in the previous method that we're talking about in Futsu Sokujo, that has to be controlled carefully over time. It's a kind of cat and mouse between the yeast and the sugar content. With Koon Toka, you don't add the lactic acid or the yeast when it's at that high temperature. And we are talking high temperatures, it's about 55 degrees Celsius. So what you've effectively done is you've made Amazake, and I've made it before at my first brewery. We had it as a standalone product. It's absolutely delicious. It's very good for you as well, but it is very sweet. So what they do then, once they've got that mash in that state, is they then start bringing the temperatures down. Now, the reason they're doing that is you couldn't add yeast and lactic acid when it's at that temperature, or you would risk killing the yeast and you would obviously seriously harm the lactic acid as well. So what you do is you bring the temperature down, it reaches a certain level where you can safely add the lactic acid in, that comes in first. And then you bring it back down to about the same temperature as a standard, maybe a bit higher than a standard Sokujo, the Futsu Sokujo, and then you add the cultured yeast. So what you've done is you've just saved yourself even more time. That whole period where you were messing around with a dakidaru or heaters and things to try and bring up the sugar content without the yeast going wild, you've just skipped right to the point where you've done all that. Now all you do is add the yeast. The yeast then goes to work on these sugars and creates alcohol. And in about 5 to 6 days, hey presto, you have a Moto. So right now in Hiroshima, that is the number one way for making Moto. And it's not unknown to see that outside of Hiroshima. It's a very popular method. But you
Right.
very, I don't know why, but you don't really hear people shouting about it from the rooftops. It doesn't really appear on labels and things. But one thing that was pointed out to me by Ishikawa Toji, which is where I get a lot of my information about Hiroshima sake, is the YK35 that you always hear about, that very famous formula, the winning formula is said to be for the Kanpyokai, which is Yamada Nishiki, Kumamoto Kobo, which is just number nine, and then 35% polishing rate. What they never mention is actually the other element to that is Koon Toka originally. So that's actually the formula. So I've heard people being negative about Koon Toka, and I can't for the life of me work out why. I've even had people say to me that they don't drink sake that's made by Koon Toka. And I really can't think why, other than there just seemed to be this tendency for people to look down upon processes that are quicker than doing it another method. I guess you could say, Kimoto has a very high reputation, quite rightly. Then below that, maybe I'm wrong in saying that, Sokujo. And then below that, you would say Koon Toka, you start to get into the quicker Sokujos. But maybe I'm just picking that up wrong, but that's the sort of feeling I get.
Yeah, I find it very interesting that someone would know enough to know that Koon Toka exists, but not know enough to know that you can't really tell the difference. Like, you just can't. Like, I drink a lot of sake that I had no idea about the Moto until I went to the brewery. I was like, oh, it's Koon Toka. Well, that's interesting. I had no idea. And that's it. Like, there's just no telling. So
Yeah.
that's, yeah.
Yeah. But just to finish on the three main ones, then we'll talk about the fourth one, which I'm still not sure I would really put in the category of Sokujo. But between futsu sokujo and koan, so that's high temperature, and the standard sokujo. There is one that we use at our brewery, and that's what I've been learning to make for the last 2 years, which is chuon sokujo. And it's a kind of like the kanji would suggest, chu is middle. So it's a good middle ground between the relatively more complicated futsu sokujo and the very fast and effective koan sokujo. There is one in the middle, and that would take about 7 to 9 days. And all you're really doing is, rather than having these really high temperatures like 55, you're raising the temperature significantly higher than the standard sokujo. We mash in at about 28 degrees Celsius. And what that does, that's an optimum temperature, again, for raising the sugar content. So you get a relatively shorter time, but not as short as koan toka, but it's not as high temperature. And it just kind of gives it a kickstart to start that process before the yeast gets up a head of steam. And then in about 7 to 8 days, you bring the temperature down gradually, or you control its descent is the best way I would say to do it. And then once you get your desired bome or sake meter value and the acidity and what have you, you can then use the motto. So they're the three that virtually anyone that's talking about Sokujo is using today.
I'm curious then. So if koan toka is common and fast, and futsu sokujo is kind of it's slower and a bit more complex, like why use chuon toka? Like what's the benefit of chuon toka over koan toka, for example?
Well, the first thing is, I'm unfortunately going to have to contradict you slightly, is people can sometimes tell the difference between these mottos. There's also, going beyond the scope of this podcast tonight, but there's also implications for the condition of the motto when you then move it into the Moromi stage. But I suppose to sort of answer your question about why would people do it, again, mentioning Ishikawa Toji, the last time I spoke to him, this is an extremely experienced Toji, what is like 30 odd years at very high levels at Takatsuru and now Tsukinoi. He's also the head of the Toji Association for Japan. So it doesn't really get much more senior than that. The last time I spoke to him, this was his new thing that he was getting into. He was investigating the differences from making koan, chuon, and futsu sokujo. So I can't answer the question because I'm just an underling, and that's the kind of level that you need to get to. There's very few people on this planet that could have a very informed conversation about the differences. But from my limited understanding of it, once you start getting into the real technical stuff of controlling Moromi, controlling the main mash, there's obviously different kinds of fermentation patterns. And how you make that motto is going to influence the Moromi as well. And of course, we have to think about the raw ingredients as well. Is it hard water? Is it soft water that you're using? What's the rice like that you're using? Is it a proper sakamai? Is it ipanmai? These are all things as well that brewers are able to experiment with and then find a sweet spot once they get it dialed in. And the type of sokujo that they're using, it has an effect. But again, overriding all of that is going to be time. Depending on your volume, depending on your production schedule and what have you, these kind of mottos, to take away the romantic side of it, how what effect it has and what have you, these were made to tackle time constraints. That's the honest thing about this. These are people trying to be more efficient in the brewery, which actually, when you start to get really deep on subjects in sake, it often leads to that when you're looking at that, the Meiji period and obviously the post and pre-war period as well. It's about making things more efficient. So that's why you've got this wide variety to choose from with Sokujo as well.
Okay, maybe someday we'll get Ishikawa Toji on to take us to school
Well, I think once he's figured out himself, I mean, the way,
on
the way he was talking, it's something that he's still experimenting with. So,
that. There you go. Well, what's the fourth one that you're hesitant to call Sokujo?
Well, I know that we both very much respect the man who wrote the book, but our friend Jorge San, I'm trying to remember which book it is of his. It's the one.
It's I think we talked about it, right? So Horie Shuji is Nihon no Seisoku Gijutsu, so a Q&A on sake brewing practices or sake brewing technology, sake brewing techniques.
Yeah, so he mentions four, I believe, in his book. He mentions Futsu Sokujo, Chuon Sokujo, Koan Sokujo, but then he puts in Kobo Jikomi, which there is no motto. That's what Kobo Jikomi is. For anyone that's not aware of what that is, Kobo just means yeast in Japanese, and Jikomi means mashing. So it's literally yeast mashing. And what they do is at the soe stage, which is the first stage of main mashing, that's after the moto stage, all they do is put in a large concentration of usually dried or powdered yeast in with the soe. So you're adding in water, koji, kakemai, and yeast. So there is no moto whatsoever. So it's not fast, it's non-existent. You're kind of going past determining speed. There is no moto to talk about, but he has put that under Sokujo K. So yeah, I kind of don't really know what to think about that.
Well,
He knows better than me, but I still can't get in my head how not having a moto is a fast way of making a moto.
I guess maybe if you're thinking it in terms of the whole process, like the scale from getting started slowly or getting started very quickly. I mean, it just doesn't get any quicker than that. There's no faster than zero moto days.
I will point out though, I've never been to a brewery or met a brewer ever that has said that they do Kobo Jikomi, but apparently it's quite well used, it's
It
quite
seems it
widespread.
I like just imagining it seems like something that would be in a more industrial setting. So like, the big producers in Nada or Fushimi might use it. I mean, there's all kinds of stuff that goes on at a very large scale that we probably wouldn't even call sake brewing. Like I just feel like, at a certain point the rules are different. So maybe it's something like that. I don't know. I'm speculating. I also have never encountered Kobo Jikomi myself.
Yeah, I would love to try it though, because just to tell, if someone said, look, that is made with Kobo Jikomi, and then maybe try another product from the same brewery to see if there's something really noticeable between the two drinks. But yeah, I mean, I'm sure at some point I've tried sake made from Kobo Jikomi. I just wasn't aware of it.
Doesn't seem like something you'd advertise.
Yeah, that is very true.
Right.
But we're not here to judge as usual. Who knows? It might not make any difference at all. But I kind of think it probably does.
It probably does. It seems to be that would, I mean, even if it's not a bad difference, it just something would have to be different about it. I mean, hey, it may be better. It may be the coming thing. In 20 years, all sake may be Kobo Jikomi. It's like, why did we waste all that time on motos? We could have just pitched the yeast from the start, and who knows? All right, so now that I guess we've laid out this idea of what Sokujo is in its variations, and Sokujo came in around the same time as Yamahai, which sort of was vaunted as this big change from traditional starters. But of course, Yamahai was a development of Kimotoke. Whereas Sokujo was a completely sort of new and left turn in many ways. What's the difference in terms of the drink? What are big differences, or are there differences? What do you think,
Well,
Andy?
it's always, I do hate to generalize in the sake industry. It's a very slippery slope to go down that because there's so much crossover in taste profiles with all sake. The lines are very blurred when you start going down that path. But in this instance, you can make a generalization between Sokujo and Kimoto or Kimoto K, Yamahai, Boraimoto, if you want to put that in there as well. And it comes down to what we mentioned before, that principles of what separate Kimoto and Sokujo. And it really is that period where lactic acid is either added in at the beginning or it's created naturally. That has a profound effect on the sake later down the line. So there is a whole period of almost 2 weeks with the fast methods of making Kimoto, where that moto has no protection. It's exposed to wild microorganisms, yeasts as well, and it's up to the skill of the brewer to try and block them out, or maybe they don't want to go to that extreme. But that's where these kind of funky flavors that you always hear about come in within Kimoto and Yamahai. And that's why, in general, Sokujo has a much cleaner profile than the latter. It really is that you get more of an expression of the yeast's true character with Sokujo, because there hasn't been that exposure element. You do just get a cleaner, I was going to say elegant there, but that would have been wrong. Definitely a cleaner flavor profile to Sokujo. So that would be one generalization that you could make, although, of course, there are always exceptions with sake.
Yeah, I think I'd concur with that. You know, obviously everybody's thinking right now, it's like, oh, well, I had this Kimoto that was really clean, or oh, I had this Sokujo that was really sort of goofy and frank and funky. And it's like, yes, there are absolutely going to be exceptions. But yeah, I think it's particularly important to note that expression of the yeast in as well. Like it's very, very much, you know, using those cultured yeasts without the interference of a lactic and nitrate reducing bacterial fermentation is going to be much more sort of direct and pure.
Yeah, I mean the changes that you get 9 times out of 10 are not going to be because of the moto. When you're talking about, you know, people say, "Oh, well, I tried this Sokujo and it had this, you know, really funky flavor profile." When you're in that realm, what you're really probably talking about is the use of something like white or black koji, or something post-production, you know, maybe aging nama or something along those lines. But if you put two tanks side by side and, you know, made one in the Kimoto and then one in Sokujo and then pressed them, hypothetically, because obviously they would take longer to make the Kimoto, but when you press them, they would be different. You would notice a difference. After that, all bets are off, because you can do all manner of things within the cycle of, you know, moto to press. That's where these are gonna you're gonna see the difference between the two, and it is because of that moto stage.
All right. So hopefully that lays some misconceptions to rest. I think it's a good idea now just to get down to where it matters. What's in the bottle? Andy, what's your recommendation for this episode?
I've been wanting to recommend this sake since we started doing this podcast. I've never found the right moment, so tonight is the night. I'm going for down to Kochi to a brewery called Hamakawa Shoten, who make Bijofu, which translated roughly means the handsome man of Tosa, which is the traditional name for the historic name for that province. It's called Ginjo Rei. There are similarly named products, so just to be specific, it's Ginjo Rei. The kanji is from Tanrei, which is of Niigata fame, so Tanrei Karakuchi. The Rei part is the kanji from Tanrei, and that gives you an idea of the character of it. It's kind of off dry. I'll be honest, it's not an expensive sake. In fact, it's very inexpensive. In Japan, it's about 1400 yen. I don't think they list the type of sake rice, and at that price, I'm guessing it's probably, you know, a table rice that they've made it with. But in terms of what we're talking about, Sokujo, I think it's a great representative of Sokujo. It's nice and clean. It's fruity. It's the first sake that I went, oh, that's melon. Like, it was just clear as day that that's melon that I was getting from it. So it's a nice, simple Ginjo that does exactly what it says on the tin. And yeah, I don't know why I associate Sokujo with that type of sake, but I do. So that would be my recommendation. Ginjo-ray from Hamakawa Shoten in Kochi Prefecture.
Awesome. I am going to go another direction. I'm going to go for a sake that makes you wonder just what this Sokujo stuff is all about, because it's really hefty and beefy. It's not clean and elegant. It's got just so much going on. And
Interesting.
it is from Nakamura Shuzo in Hagi City, and it is called Takarabune. I'm recommending just their plain Junmai. And this is a sake that I can tell you was Kōun Touka. I've talked to the brewer about it, and I asked him, like, why do you do Kōun Touka? And he's like, I don't know. That's just what we always do. And so it is a Kōun Touka, and it's a no jun amakuchi in the style that I think probably would have defined Yamaguchi sake 50 years ago. Like, it's heavy and it's rich. It's not off. It's not cloying. But it definitely has the kind of character that strikes you as out of date. I think it's great. I think a lot of people will probably find it a bit much for them. But I think it also sort of attests to the fact that, yeah, Sokujo, it has that potential for really sort of direct, clean yeast expression, but it also is just a way of making sake that expresses the brewer's intent and skill in its own way. So, Takarabune Junmai from Hagi.
Fantastic. That's a great recommendation, Jim, but we are going to have to set a rule that next time you're not allowed to use a Yamaguchi brewery.
No way. Listen, I accepted the no gokyo rule for a while, but come on. What else? What else am I going to recommend? Okay. I see where this is going. All right.
Another prefecture
Another
sake.
prefecture sake. All right. I suppose we can do that, but
Something to work on for next time.
just under the wire, there's a Yamaguchi sake for you. Okay. So, Andy, now that we've gone through all of that, what's our takeaway for today?
The takeaway today would be that I guess Sokujo is a lot more complicated than it probably seems. So, because you often hear very simple explanations that Sokujo is this fast brewing method that took off in the early 20th century. Perish the thought. There's really nothing simple in the sake industry. It's also a very complex topic, and there is a lot to the different styles of Sokujo. We really just scratched the surface tonight, to be honest. But like you said during the episode, the main thing is what's in your glass, whether you like it or not. So it's an interesting topic, but don't get too hung up on it.
Sounds good to me. All right. So that was our Sokujo episode. Thank you all very much for listening to yet another Sake Deep Dive. I have been Jim Ryan. You can find me online at Jim_D_Ryan on Twitter all the time. That's RION. Lots of other places. Be sure to pre-order my book, Discovering Yamaguchi Sake, coming out next February. Should be a lot of fun. Andy, how about yourself?
I'm much more humble than Jim. I don't have a book coming out or anything like that. You can just find me on my website, www.originsake.com, and you can get the various social media links on there. And there's also a contact page as well.
Good stuff. Thanks very much. All right, everybody. Be sure to drink responsibly. Stay dry out there and kanpai.
Kanpai.